The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
We can help your company and your employees look forward to tomorrow. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. You can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcasts. This week, we're focusing on the business of sport, and I'm joined in studio by my regular co-host for the slot, Michael O'Keefe, Chief Executive of Teneo PSG. Michael, you're very welcome again.
Ciarán, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Now, later in the show, we'll be discussing Irish cricket's elevation to test status and the countdown to our first test match against Pakistan in Malahide starting on May 11th. Cricket Ireland Chief Executive Warren Dutrum will join us in studio along with Irish Times cricket writer Emmett Reardon. But as usual, we're going to begin with our business of sport wrap-up. Michael, we're going to talk about, and it pains me to say it, we're going to talk about Liverpool and the whole issue of football agents. Liverpool, of course, qualifying for the semi-finals of the UEFA Champions League. Hip, hip, hooray.
Yes, we're all delighted. Yeah, as a Man United fan, I was hoping they could both get knocked out, but it's not possible, unfortunately.
But interestingly, according to the Football Association's annual review of the monies paid to football agents, and we know it's a lot these days, Liverpool came out on top of that ranking as well.
Yeah, there's a very interesting piece of work done. And, you know, there's always been this conversation around the power of agents and the monies that they make. And it's quite complicated as well, but you're kind of staggering number of 211 million pounds was paid out to agents in fees last year, which is an enormous sum of money when you think about it. And you know, they're taking anywhere between 8-9% and 40% of the overall transfer fee. And you consider the amount of money that players are exchanging hands for, even average players are going for 10 and 20 million. You know, it's an enormous market. Liverpool are top of the league in something anyway. Obviously with Virgil van Dijk's move is one of the big high profile moves of the last while.
£75 million, yeah. Salah 35, Oxlade-Chamberlain 40 million.
Yeah, and there's always been this kind of murky shadow of agents and, you know, deals that have been done with managers who prefer certain agents and all that, prefer certain clubs and stuff like that. And this was done over a period that took in the two transfer windows, was would have been February 2017 up to Jan 2018. But the numbers are absolutely enormous. I think when you spread it out across the other leagues within the UK, it's £257 million, which is up 17% year on year. So maybe we'll change career, Ciarán.
Well, it's quite obscene though, isn't it? £2.5 billion from transfer fees in 5 years these agents have earned.
Yeah, and UEFA had a stat as well, which was 13% of all revenues from transfers from 2013 to 2017 have gone to agents. So it just shows you it's this industry in itself that seems to surround football for better or for worse. And you just wonder how long will it take before the bubble can burst in this, because you wonder, is it good sometimes in the interest of the clubs? Is it in the interest of football?
Yeah, well, given your storied background in soccer, Michael, with Shamrock Rovers and others, I'm wondering why you ended up in PR when you could have been a football agent.
Well, there was always the story that I was the only player Rovers gave a washing machine away to get rid of me, so I don't. In the Whirlpool days, as you'll remember.
All right, very good. Well, indeed, as you put it to good use in terms of spinning. Let's just say that. Let's move on to rugby. Now, good news last weekend, obviously, with Munster and Leinster winning through, or indeed the weekend before that, winning through to the European Champions Cup semi-finals.
Yeah.
And they've got tough games ahead. Leinster, fortunately, will have a home tie at the Aviva, but Munster having to travel to France. How much is this going to be worth to the sport here?
So, like a lot of competitions, the more you progress throughout the competition, obviously the more money is generated. The RFU, who obviously own the provinces, have already had a fantastic financial year where with their bonus structures, which this paper covered, of in the region of €5 million already for winning the Six Nations. So when you take that into context here, there was 300,000 win bonus for both teams the last time around, and another 600,000 for the winner of the final, and 400,000 compensation for the loser of the final. So Leinster and or Munster hopefully will get that far, and which would be a significant £1 million extra into the RFU coffers.
This is money that goes to the RFU rather than the provinces.
Well, de facto, by going to the provinces, it's going into the RFU, because the accounts which would account for all. So it would go to the provinces first, but you know, it is Irish rugby where the money ends up eventually.
Yeah. And what people mightn't realise is that this game in the Aviva, it's a semi-final stage now of this Champions Cup competition. It's not a match that's actually organised by the RFU.
No, it's not. So the EPCR actually run this match, and basically they rent the Aviva and they own the fixture. So it's not technically a home fixture match for Leinster or Irish rugby. What is interesting is that if a Parisian team had got this far, they don't play in Paris. But Leinster, been, you know, primarily a Dublin-based team, although they obviously have a 12-county base, can play their game in Dublin and maybe not have to travel to a Belfast or Limerick, because it's technically a home country semi-final, but Leinster are allowed to play their game in Dublin.
All right, chances of both Irish provinces winning? What do you think?
I think it'd be fantastic if one got there. You'd have to say Leinster have a far better chance than Munster and a deeper squad. I think it's going to be a huge ask for Munster to go to France and win. But on the final itself, if anybody is looking to book, there are no hotel rooms in Bilbao. I've looked into this. So
are maybe, there pubs? That's the key thing.
There are lots of pubs. There are lots of pubs. There's lots of food and a beautiful stadium, but there are absolutely no hotel rooms. And I think, you know, a fantastic idea to bring a rugby final to the heart of the Basque Country, and I get it.
But it's a
soccer playing area. They're not used to away fans, and it's not a massive tourist town, so there actually isn't the hotel infrastructure. And I think in hindsight, you know, I don't know where fans are actually going to stay, because they're looking at €900 a hotel room, I think, at the moment, and there's 5% of hotel rooms left, so it's going to be tight.
Well, I think of that Christy Moore song, didn't Jock Sargon his van and to Stuttgart?
I think
he kept in as well.
I'd say that will be how a lot of Leinster fans or Munster fans may actually have to go by boat and bus or boat and camper van, you know. So
Conor McGregor, he's been a bit of a naughty boy in New York.
Yes, yes, he's been a very naughty boy, and the more cynical minded of us might think that it was all a bit of a stunt, but
I think it's a spectacular backfire.
So
just remind people what happened.
So yeah, before there was a kind of a weigh-in and a UFC meetup, which is a very UFC thing where they have these massive kind of media events. McGregor got into a bit of a scrap and his people with another bunch of UFC guys. The world being the way it is now, there's a book of the video evidence of this. He was downstairs in a car park underneath a hotel in Brooklyn, threw something at a bus, which caused the window to smash and injured a fellow UFC fighter. He's been come down very hard upon by Dana White of UFC. And has been, and charges were pressed. So, you know, precariously for him, I think the visa situation is the one he would probably be most concerned about. Mm. Now, he can fight outside of America as well, but America being the home of sports business, you don't necessarily want to preclude yourself from earning money in the States. The only thing I'd say is that when you look at the top 25 sports stars in the world, and McGregor is number 25, only 10% of his income comes from endorsements and brand ambassador kind of deals, whereas a Ronaldo or a Messi, their kind of external reputation and brand is probably much more important to him. And ironically, you know, the notoriety that he's built around himself, like, he'll probably sell more pay-per-view packages on the back of this if he does get into fight again. You would worry that this fella seems to be careering off track a little bit, to say the least, and you'd like to think that he can steady himself and get back into it.
You might say it was a whopper of a mistake, which yes, ties in neatly perhaps with his 10 million sponsorship deal with the popular fast food chain Burger King.
Yes, and he does have a number of sponsors like Monster Energy and a few of these guys, Reebok, Bud Light. He's also got his own style of whiskey without an E, I think, as well, which was also covered by this paper.
Notorious. So, maybe who's fueled up with that when this thing happened. Anyway, right, let's talk about it. We're going to finish now on some sponsorship deals. We've five that we're going to rattle through. We've got Indian Premier League sponsorship. We've got some UK rugby. A couple of soccer ones actually involving the FIFA World Cup, which of course is coming up in the summer, and also related to Roma, the Italian football club that heroically pulled off that famous comeback against Barcelona last night.
All very timely stuff, so we're going to hear from cricket now in a minute, but the Mumbai Indians, where cricket is absolutely enormous in India, as we'll probably hear later on, they've done a huge deal with Samsung in their stadium, but it would also see a kind of a T20 themed sale of mobile products.
You'd be a big fan now of the Mumbai.
Huge cricket fan, actually, Indians, as well, and obviously followed the Indian Premier League quite closely.
And I'm sure
closely.
You have a Samsung TV. So
I absolutely have a Samsung TV.
There's a certain synergy
and
here
a Samsung
for you, Michael.
Phone. Yes, so all of the above. Another deal we saw was rugby, a big deal in rugby actually, where insurance giant Arthur J. Gallagher will replace Aviva as the title sponsor of English rugby.
Now, I know it's a thing or two about insurance and about business, Michael, and I have to confess I've never heard of Arthur J. Gallagher.
I have to say, I hadn't myself, but they are a US insurance giant, Kieran. I'll have you reliably know.
Okay, well, most things in the US are giant. But anyway, all right, closer to home, a Newry-based company, Statsports, which the Irish Times has been writing about quite a bit of late. They've signed a very lucrative deal with the Brazil Football Federation ahead of the World Cup. Tell us about Statsports.
These guys are going from strength to strength. As you say, an Irish company and one of a few Irish kind of sports companies that are doing well globally. This is a really big, high-profile deal, and it's kind of been on these sports business websites in the last couple of days. So they've done a deal with the Brazilian national soccer team to be their players' monitoring devices. So those things that you see, the trackers that players wear.
Yes, I think Lee Keegan threw one at Dean Rock at the end of the
I think it might have slipped out of his hands. Yeah, so didn't put Dean off, thankfully. You see the black object coming. Yeah, but it is that kind of deal. So, but enormously successful. And you know, you have to say it's great to see an Irish company do so well. They also work with England, Man United, Man City, Liverpool, etc. So
right, okay. Now, consumer electronics company Hisense from China has become an official sponsor of the World Cup in Russia and of the FIFA Confederations Cup as well.
I think it's the interesting piece of this is that the FIFA World Cup has actually struggled to get regional sponsors. There's been a bit of a cloud around Russia been hosting this, and there's obviously a lot of negativity towards Russia at the moment as well, and they've actually struggled to attract major multinationals to sponsor the World Cup itself. But we have seen a number of Chinese companies come in as regional partners, as they call them. It would be very late normally for this to be the case. So you would often find that a sponsor will come in 2 years out and do all their bits and bobs that they need to do. In saying that, FIFA have still, you know, got the likes of Budweiser and McDonald's and all the usual people that they would have had. But, you know, you would say that commercially, the Russian World Cup so far, there would be question marks about its success to attract sponsors.
Right, okay. We mentioned Roma. They had a very famous victory against Barcelona last night in UEFA Champions League. It's put them into the semi-finals. They came from 3 goals behind to win and put Barcelona out of the competition. And they've signed a sponsorship deal with Hyundai.
Yeah, and similar to your own Shamrock Rovers, who are a partner of Hyundai, Kieran.
Well, I like to think of Shamrock Rovers as being similar to Roma, actually, Michael, now that you mention it.
We all do. But yes, great result for Roma last night. And interestingly, they've been out without a shirt sponsor since 2013, which, you know, would make you think that Italian soccer has been at a fairly low ebb. Outside of Juventus, there's been a bit of a struggle. They've had problems with stadia, problems with violence, racism and so on. But
Corruption,
yeah, and a lot of other issues as well. But it seems to be that Italian soccer is having a bit of a comeback, which is great.
Mm. Well, now mind you, they missed out in the World Cup.
They missed out in the World Cup. I'm more focused on the Serie A teams. But yes, you're correct to state that they did miss out on the World Cup. But this is a big deal for them. And I suppose the surprising piece for me here is that they were out of sponsor for so long. And they are, I think, looking the way Juve have gone from the kind of the big old-fashioned municipal stadium with the track and all that, which was quite an old-fashioned style, to a kind of a smaller ground, the Stadio della Roma, apparently is where they're going to be moving to.
All right. Okay. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be talking about Ireland's elevation to the top table of global cricket with Cricket Ireland CEO Warren Dusham. Back in a few moments.
At Irish Life, we can tell you that 49% of employees in Ireland don't think about tomorrow. They don't have a pension plan. We can help you help them. Because if you're involved in running your company's pension plan, we can administer it for you. With our member-specific investment solutions, online access for employers, trustees and members, and always-on smartphone apps. Just call one of our corporate team on 01704 1845. Visit irishlifecorporatebusiness.ie or contact your pension consultant to find out how we can help your company think of tomorrow. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life September 2014.
Now, welcome back. This is Inside Business with Kieran Hancock. You can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcasts. This week, we're focusing on the business of sport, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host for the slot, Mick O'Keefe of Teneo PSG. Michael, Ciara, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
All right. And we're also joined in studio, I'm delighted to say, by Cricket Ireland Chief Executive Warren Dutram and by the Irish Times cricket writer Emmett Reardon. And huge excitement in Irish cricket circles at the minute ahead of next month's historic first ever test match against Pakistan in Malahide. And this, of course, will be followed by a T20 series against India in June. Warren is Chief Executive of Cricket Ireland, and is in his 11-year tenure, Ireland has grown in stature in world cricket and was recently awarded full member status of the ICC, one of only 12 nations in the world to receive that status. It was a long-running campaign by Ireland, Warren, and one that you, I know, were centrally involved in. So you must be delighted to be on the cusp of this first test match against Pakistan. How are preparations going?
Well, I hope. On a pretty regular basis, I get updates from the marketing and sales team about how we're doing on ticketing and hospitality. We have, I think, only ever sold maybe a maximum of about 15,000 tickets in any one year previously.
And they would have been for one-day games.
They would have been for one-day games, exactly. We've now given ourselves a target to sell of 30,000, in fact, 31,000 to be precise. So, yeah, it's a stretch target.
So how many are gone?
We're halfway there at the moment. We're, I think, 14, 8, 15, something like that, as of this morning, with a month to go. So in terms of pre-sales, being more than halfway at this stage is better than we've ever done beforehand. We've, for the first time, we've really done a lot more in terms of external marketing. Sort of, you've seen the backs of buses, and we've seen sort of, you know, big 48 sheet posters in Malahide, and bus shelters in parts of Dublin as well. So in terms of visibility, I think, and I hope, we're giving ourselves the best chance.
Yeah, very good. And just in terms, I mean, what's this going to be worth in revenue terms for Cricket Ireland?
Well, in terms of tickets and hospitality match income this year, we'd be looking at round about 570,000-580,000 in terms of the revenue. That's purely ticketing and hospitality. If we look on top of that broadcast, that's a much bigger revenue stream. We'd be looking, in terms of broadcast, to hit, both in terms of overseas and domestic sales, around about 1.8 million euros this year. So we've really sort of crossed, I think, Rubicon in terms of the amount of revenue we're generating from broadcast sales. Previously, it was very much, well, frankly, when I was selling it myself, didn't really know the market well enough, picked up the phone to a few people I know. Now we've engaged an overseas agency called Pitch International, who work with a number of the overseas boards in New Zealand, Australia, England, etc. They know the market very well. They engage with all the broadcasters. That's put us into an entirely new platform or level in terms of our ability to, I suppose, sweat the asset, which is, if you look at it in terms of the business model of the vast majority of pre-existing full members, it's driven nearly exclusively, or to a large extent, I should say, by broadcast sales. And we're just beginning to dip our toe into that water. So for us, it's an exciting potential revenue stream in the future.
For those who want to watch the game, you know, those living in Ireland who want to watch the game live, where can they see it?
We're going to be making an announcement of that hopefully early next week, both in terms of live ball-by-ball coverage on television, on radio, and highlights too.
And feel free to announce it here exclusively, Warren, as well. But just in terms of broadcast, I'm always fascinated by cricket. Was one of the first to embrace YouTube in India and so forth. Is there a view to maybe kind of diversifying your broadcast partners, so to speak, particularly with such vast audiences in Asia and so on?
The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is, because we've never traditionally had to rely upon broadcast income in order to, I suppose, get to the stage we are at the moment, i.e. Getting towards test status, in many ways it's cream, and a lot of the existing test nations are fascinated by how we've actually managed to build the business without relying upon broadcast income. And why haven't we? Well, because we've never had sufficient fixtures planable over a lengthy period of time to get there. So in other words, rather than necessarily looking at saying, well, let's try and sweat every single one of our fixtures through a linear broadcast model, maybe we can be a little bit more innovative. So I think with the Test and T20, because they're, especially against India, and looking at the Asian market, because they're very significant markets financially. And I think that's one of cricket's unique selling points, the ability to penetrate that South Asian market, particularly India. It gives us an opportunity to perhaps be a little bit more innovative with our Afghan fixtures, which we're playing three ODIs and three T20Is in August. So it may give us a chance to say, well, maybe we could look at a Facebook and that sort of thing, which is, you know, I like the idea of being the first to do something or being innovative in cricket. That's something that excites me.
And just take a step back a little bit, and for those maybe not familiar with Cricket Ireland, could you give us a sense of the organisation that is Cricket Ireland, the revenue, the commercial partners, and how that's all made up?
Yeah, sure. Maybe the best way to start is, where were we? I arrived at the end of 2006. And by that stage, I'd have had the annual accounts from 2005 to look at. And that would have been, our turnover at that stage was about €260,000. We're projecting this year to be around about 9.2, 9.3 million. So it's obviously grown exponentially in terms of participation figures. We've grown quite significantly. Sorry, to stick to your question, we would have had, of that, probably round about 30, 35, 40% back in 2006 was government income. Now government income is about 720 between Sport Northern Ireland and the Sport Ireland. And that's around about 8% of turnover. ICC accounts now for about 50% of our revenue, which is very significant. But interestingly, that was about 50% last year when we were 6 million. So we've had to work really hard to generate more income. So sponsorship-wise, between cash and in-kind, it's now around about 1.4, 1.5 million euros. We've got a spread of about 14, 15 partners. Our headline partner is It's Turkish Airlines, which is the men's senior squad partner, which for us was terrific because it's a, you know, a national carrier. It's very aggressive in terms of their marketing. It's terrific for us. We can obviously leverage off that. Broadcast now, I think I mentioned, is about 1.8 million. With another 500,000-600,000 in terms of match income, we've had to work really, really hard in self-generated income. And I think that's been one of the real strengths of Cricket Ireland over the years.
Yeah, that's a big success story. But I presume costs have gone up in the meantime too.
Yeah, they have. One of the challenges of an organisation our size is that achieving test status comes with a whole series of obligations. And one of which is running a test match. And running a test match on a greenfield site is incredibly expensive. So whereas last year, it was our events program cost about 1.3 million euros. This year, we project it's going to cost about 2.7 million euros. That's enormous.
That's the cost of staging games in Malahide.
That's the cost of staging games. In fact, that's our entire events program. Not just Malahide, but the reason it's expanded so much is because of the cost of Test cricket and T20s as well. We're also paying for all the costs of pretty much everything in terms of the temporary infrastructure that goes into a game. I'm trying to remember who it was, whether it was Emmett or whether it was J.S. Siggins, but the phrase pop-up stadium perfectly illustrates exactly what you're looking at. It's a greenfield site. Yeah. And
beside Malahide Castle there for people who know Malahide Castle.
That's right. That's right within the Malahide Castle grounds.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, the only thing you can't see on a match day is the only thing that's permanently there all the time, which is the pavilion. But it's the thing that, because it's not accredited for international usage, because of the size of dressing rooms and the facilities, we have to bring every single thing in terms of players changing, match officials working areas, VIP areas, everything.
Warren, just in terms of this, it's a 5-day test match against Pakistan. It's your first sort of dipping of a toe in the water of test match cricket. What's the income from that match for Cricket Ireland, hopefully, you know, providing everything goes to plan? And what's the expenditure?
The match itself is around about 1.1 million euros in terms of cost. It won't wash its face as a standalone test match. So we'll be relying upon the revenues from the T20 games, particularly the overseas broadcast revenues, to offset. The revenues that we'd be expecting from the test match, I don't have the breakdown of broadcast, because what we tend to do is we tend to aggregate all the broadcast revenues across all the matches that we play in all of the, against all the targets or markets we're selling in. But I can tell you it's going to be a loss. And by and large, I think you would find that across the world, test cricket tends to be loss-making.
Yeah.
And particularly when you're doing it in in a greenfield site without permanent facilities.
Okay, we might talk to you a little later on just about your plans for a new stadium. I want to bring Emmett in at this point, because Emmett, you've been writing about the Irish cricket team and their successes on the field now for a number of years. So it must be very exciting to be on the cusp of a home first test match. You know, the hand of history on your shoulder, perhaps. But also maybe just explain to us what the import of this elevation to test status is for Irish cricket.
Well, I think we only have to look back to the events in South Africa, and obviously because of what happened in South Africa with the ball tampering, and in Australia, where it was a national scandal. And they say the captain of the Australian cricket team is more important than the Prime Minister. And looking at Australian politics, yeah, I'm not too surprised with that. But Test cricket is the pinnacle. I mean, I'm looking back in the history books, and this is our first test coming up. New Zealand, it took them 26 years to win their first test. So we're talking about a return on investment. Everything is recorded in Test cricket. It goes back. The history is there of every match. So that we can enter in, and Afghanistan, let's say, as well, because there's two teams starting off, but obviously Ireland are playing in the first test. It's just fantastic that we enter into this history. We are slotting in, and I think anyone who's interested in cricket in Ireland, it will be a magical, I think it'll be an emotional day, and even for the journalists, I know, because Warren and everyone in cricket Ireland, I think there'll be a lot of emotion when it comes to the event itself. But it does put us on the highest level. And we're also there, just to give Warren a bit of kudos here, this is 2 years ahead of what was an optimistic strategic plan by Cricket Ireland. So it was 2020. I was actually looked back at the material before yesterday. So we're ahead of schedule. And looking back in longer into the history of Cricket Ireland, you know, there was warnings about, you know, may you live in interesting times. Like this is a warning, like because of our fixture list. I looked back at an old report where there was disappointing sales, and including the sales of ties, which was costing the income of Cricket Ireland. So in the 21 years, and this is back in 1996 when I started covering it, and you look back at what it was, where the biggest game was the Duchess of Norfolk's 11 in Arundel Castle in England. And, you know, suddenly we went into playing, you know, one-day matches in England. Suddenly our international schedule, one-day matches, when we look at 1996, was it against England in Stormont?
2006,
yep. Sorry, yes, of course. And it's kind of built up, but in the last 5 or 10 years, the change is incredible.
Yeah, and of course we've had these famous Cricket World Cup victories, both in 50 over and a T20 format. But another benefit, I suppose, Emmett, of Test match status is that it might hopefully prevent the bleed of some of our best young talent to the English cricket side. We've seen Owen Morgan is obviously captain of England's 50 over and 20 over teams, but he played test matches for England as well. And Joyce and Boyd Rankin also declared for England. They're both now back in the Irish ranks.
Yeah, I think it's also, well, just say it's a helper and a hindrance. From next year, and Irish cricketers will not really be playing in county cricket. But now there's a first-class structure in Ireland. This is the most important thing. And I think, Warren, like, there's a lot of money spent in the first-class structure keeping cricketers here in Ireland and giving them a meaningful level of cricket to play in. It won't be at the level of the county championship for a long time. These things take time to build up. But if these players are playing here all the time, we've already had players come back from county cricket and are playing in the interprovincial series. So these things are vital to bring it into it. But we will not, our players, unless they're absolutely exceptional players. And let's be honest, this was a golden generation. I mean, for Ed Joyce and Owen Morgan, Kevin O'Brien, Niall O'Brien, Boyd Rankin, for all these guys to come along together at the same time, and I'm leaving plenty of them out there, it's an incredible golden generation. And we can see how hard it is to develop an international cricketer. And we have some young players coming through now who are fantastic. Andrew Balburnie is establishing himself in the side. Obviously, Paul Sterling is a veteran of multiple hundreds of caps, but he's still only kind of mid-20s or so. So it's a tough job, but the development of the structure in Ireland, the interprovincial structure, is huge to it, and it has to. That's where a huge amount of money has been put.
By far and away are probably the biggest legacy that whenever I shuffle off the Cricket Ireland coil, the biggest legacy I think I'll leave, I hope, will be provincial union growth development. We were always very much a club game, and there was some international cricket, as Emmett referred to earlier on. We're always very much more club-based with a few international fixtures. We then became club-based with a load of international fixtures and more into the future. And what was happening was the more international cricket we were playing, The higher standard we were playing of cricket, the leap from club to country was becoming enormous. So what we needed to do as quickly as possible was put in place that middle structure, provincial unions. And then what we found was that even just putting in place the cricket side of it, all of the other stuff comes in, which is how are they going to commercialise, how are they going to sweat that asset, how are they going to develop appropriate revenue streams, governance structures. And that's the really big part of the jigsaw I'm trying to do at the moment, working with our provincial unions, who, by the way, are fantastic in terms of their willingness to embrace change in terms of the game. If I look back 10 years, changed our governance structure at Cricket Ireland, which was something that the game had to embrace. Were they prepared to slim down an executive committee of 18 people, 19 people, to a board of only 11 or 12, including independent directors? We introduced the interprovincial structure. We asked the provincial unions whether they would change their top domestic leagues in terms of the number of teams playing in it, so we could get best v best and thereby create the space for interprovincial matches. We've really had massive support from those provincial unions, and that for me is a massive focus, because that's going to be, I think, the real fulcrum on which the game is going to pivot in the future, because we're not going to be anything in terms of strength of either our club game, which is enormously important to develop the players, and that's where players for the Interpros come from, and internationally, of course, unless we're testing them at that lower level down, we're never going to find international cricketers.
How much inspiration did you take from rugby in that in this country? You went to a very similar process.
Yeah, we did. And in fact, I've spoken to Philip Brown on a couple of occasions. He's extremely generous with his time and with his staff's time as well, in terms of, Philip, how did you do this? How did you do that? Certainly before we, it wasn't so much on the playing structure, but it was more on the governance structure, ownerships. And it's a fascinating model. And of course, with this year's Six Nations, you can really see, whereas previously, was it 2 or 3 years ago, Ireland team isn't doing too well, and some of the provinces weren't performing that well, and it was suddenly, well, is the provincial model quite right? Now everyone's praising it to the sky, saying, yeah, wow, isn't it brilliant? And this top-down ownership from the IRFU, and that was really helpful to us to understand. Do we want the governance model whereby IRFU is in charge and almost like a benevolent dictator supporting all the provincial unions in terms of their growth? Or is it going to be a bit like an ICC where all of the members holds the vast majority of the power? And trying to find a governance structure that pulls those two forces together is fascinating, and we are right in the kernel of that at the moment.
Just one question for you again on cricket and the playing population. We're a very busy sporting nation, and we have indigenous sports as well, obviously, which complicates the picture, I suppose, for international sport. Can you give us a sense of the playing numbers? You almost touched on it there. And also where cricket has been traditionally strong and where maybe there's growth potential for cricket.
Sure. Once again, I'll go back to 2006 when I arrived. The numbers were about 11,000. I say about because we didn't have really the means to be able to count those properly. Now we tend to say about 50, 52,000. Now, are those people, is that 52,000 who regularly play the game, club cricket, weekend in, weekend out? No. The numbers of regular players has probably fluctuated only to a small degree from 11,000. What we've done is put more boots on the ground through development officers, more support to our provincial unions to be able to introduce the game to more people through clubs, schools, development officers, etc. Our trick is to transform or to convert that, I suppose, involvement into lifelong participation through clubs.
Traditionally, clubs more than schools, though, would that be correct?
Traditionally, clubs more than schools. Mm. And there's almost a practical reason for that. The school, the cricket playing term is pretty short. Mm. I mean, if we're talking about the summer term, that's always cut down by, well, I think we mentioned weather a little bit earlier on, and the small measure of exams. So the important thing is to try and get kids into club life, because that lasts throughout a very lengthy summer. And that's where we do have a benefit. You've got 3 months, June, July, August, to summertime, where cricket has the opportunity to go back to your earlier question, potentially co-own the summer with hurling. And that's that's a great opportunity we have. And obviously we have this international consideration as well. And with, I guess, a lot of immigration into Ireland from South Asian communities, that gives us the opportunity to introduce people to the game whom we don't have to tell, look, it's a great game, you can love it. They're already come with this inbuilt, hardwired affection for the sport. And the challenge there is actually to say, well, how and where can I access it, rather than here's a great sport you might give a try to.
Emmett, we missed out on the Cricket World Cup. That was a big disappointment. Obviously great to have Test match cricket, but everybody wants to be playing at the World Cup next year in England, 2019. But unfortunately, the ICC changed the structure of the tournament. We had to go through a qualifier and we didn't make it. It's a big blow, isn't it?
It's a huge blow. It's in England and Wales. And the format is you play 9 matches. And this is because of India. And this goes back to the 2007 World Cup, where Ireland knocked out Pakistan and Bangladesh knocked out India. So the famous game between India and Pakistan was Ireland beating Bangladesh. And after that, that was never going to happen again. It's to do with TV. So they want India want 9 games on television. But Ireland playing 9 games in our next-door neighbour, now post-Brexit or whatever, it'll still be easy enough to get over to the matches. It's a huge blow. And I'm sure Warren will talk about it, that the exposure of that to Ireland live on television as well is massive, and it does leave a gap, and it's in our summer, it's all that that's going on as well. So it's a huge blow.
Yeah, and I'll say yes and no because I don't want to be retrospectively saying, oh, well, we never bothered about the World Cup or didn't really care about it that much. Yes, look, did we want to qualify? Absolutely. Is it as mortal, perhaps, a blow as it might have been in the past? The answer to that, I think, is emphatically no. And I remember saying at our annual awards last year that by virtue of getting test status, what always happened in the past is that we performed well at a qualifier, we got to a World Cup, and we had this massive spotlight shone on Irish cricket for the, you know, couple of weeks leading into the event, and then maybe the 6-7, in fact, actually, cricket World Cup lasts about 9 weeks, isn't it? But that period of the event. And then we sort of slunk into this obscurity between. What's going to happen is nearly going to be the opposite now. We're going to have the visibility in between the World Cups, and we're going to miss the, I guess, the opportunity that we would otherwise have had to have that global spotlight. And I guess for the Irish public, because they've only ever known the World Cup and they've never known the stuff in between, until the stuff in between starts, i.e. test matches, games against India, T20s, ODIs against Afghanistan, and then overseas cricket, which we're going to have, people then going to see, okay, well, it's now a much more regular hit, visible, sort of plays into this whole making cricket mainstream catch line that we've come up with, which is, yes, we want to be much more culturally visible, culturally ubiquitous out there with the rugbys and the Gaelics and the footballs of this world, which I know if I'd said that 3 or 4 years ago, I'd have been strapped to a gurney and whipped off to the, you know, whipped off to an institution. But now I believe that is,
well,
that's feasible.
Just to say, back to the point, it's wrong in the first place. The ICC having a 10-team World Cup is ridiculous. Former colleague of yours, Andrew Leonard, did all the major field sport World Cups, and he did a map, coloured in map, and it went viral. And it's just incredible the lack of, you know, like 10 countries playing in a World Cup while every other sport is expanding. But we won't go there, really.
Let me not be in any way disingenuous. I mean, to say that I know I was involved to a large degree in trying to overturn some of the former decisions around the 10-team World Cup. I'm not going to plead the fifth on it now. Do I agree with it? No. Have I made my point behind the scenes? Absolutely. Will I continue to do so? Absolutely. It's something we do not agree with, whether we've qualified for the event or not. And I'm trying not to make it sound as if it's sour grapes, that the only reason we're fighting it is because we now haven't qualified. Don't agree with the 10-team World Cup for all the reasons that Emmett has eloquently said.
What do you say to the criticism, and maybe Emmett, you could answer this as well, around that maybe test status has come a little late for the golden generation of Irish cricket, or is that a fair statement to make?
It's probably true from the point of view of, like, Ed Joyce is hanging in there. He's had various operations, but he wants to stay on and play in the first test. But will he be playing test cricket in 2 or 3 years' time? It's not going to be the case. And a lot of that golden generation are heading into their, you know, early 30s and stuff like that. Yeah, but if we look back at it, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, would it have been, I'm asking you, Warren, like, would it have been too early?
Why do we become a test nation? Why do we chase it? I suppose there's a practical thing, which is to have waved all the flags and say, yeah, you were a full member. Mm. It would have been lots of shoulder shrugging here and saying, what's that? Who cares? Test nation is the tag. That's the thing that people can get behind. And there was a period in the run-up to the decision being made last year where there was still a big question mark, because the game is disinclined to want to create more test nations because of the incredible cost that there is on those nations to have to pay for it. So why did we do it? We did it because it's the best. So if we had remained an associate, it's almost by definition second best. Test cricket's the best. It's the pinnacle. It's what all of the former players, current players, media say is the primary format. Therefore, if we weren't pursuing it, we'd be second best.
And yes, Warren, can I just cut across you there and say that a lot of people lately are saying that Test cricket is dead because the crowds at Test cricket across the world are appalling. And if you strip out, let's say, the Ashes between England and Australia, you know, Test cricket is interesting. Test cricket is dwindling, particularly the West Indies. It used to be a huge force back in the 70s and 80s. And it's, you know, a lot of their top star players are deciding not to play Test cricket. They're playing, you know, they're playing T20 or they're playing 50 over cricket.
And to say the ICC isn't aware of that would be incorrect. So I'm aware of the fact that at the moment there's a big strategic review, which is, you know, the usual thing, bit of navel gazing every 4 years. What should you do about the next 4 years? Now, the ICC, it's not just doing it from the perspective of let's look at it as an organisation. It's looking at where do we see world cricket? And it's not where do we see world cricket in the next 4 years. It's putting it underneath a vision. You know, the strategy should fit beneath a much bigger view of where the sport's going to be by 2030. And where do we see Test cricket in that time? So to say that the game isn't trying to address it and recognising it, and will it be four-day matches? Will it be four-day matches run Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, get rid of the Monday dead day? Can we look to have more matches played from on a floodlit basis? Should we play so much Test cricket? And that's certainly the view that Cricket Ireland takes. We don't think we should be playing more than maybe one or two matches a year. Let's introduce context to Test cricket. At the moment, it's just nation v nation. Well, that's just got some historical context. It doesn't have competitive context. The introduction of the Test League is supposed to do all that. Now, you can say, well, let's throw another two or three things at it, and then you're never quite sure, well, which one worked and which one didn't work. So I think the three things that I've mentioned, reducing the number of days, looking more at floodlit games, maybe reducing the number, less is more, and then putting context into the league structure, competitive structure, I think those are three or four pretty decent innovations which will hopefully try and arrest some of the considerations. But there's no doubt. I mean, if you're looking for one stat that is going to make all those who love the game sit up and take notice, it's the fact that in the Indian broadcast market, the same value is ascribed to a T20 game that lasts 3 hours as there is to a test match. And if you're looking from a business perspective about, well, what should I as a person managing our sport invest in, you know, in terms of return on investment, well then,
It's like, so, you know, the Irish soccer team plays at Diviva, the Irish rugby team plays at Diviva, GA, big games are at Croke Park. In cricket, it's different. You don't have a permanent base as such. Games bob about, Malahide, Stormont, other venues have been used around the country as well.
Turf, don't forget.
Indeed. And I remember going to see Ireland play Wales in cricket many years ago in Kimmage. It's now Ben Dunn gym, but it used to be, I think, the Carlisle Cricket Club
or
used
McCabe,
to...
Or was it?
Used to play there. So, but you're hoping to resolve that problem by getting a new base out in Aberystwyth. Where are you at?
Yes and no. So we are resolving the issue of where we're going to play our Dublin-based matches. But cricket has a tradition, and cricket has a tradition of taking its matches around its country. So Australia does it all the way across its six territories. Similarly with England as well, across, you know, the test match or the international venues. Why? Because there's so much international cricket. So much international cricket played on any given pitch wears a pitch out. And so you just need a whole series of fixtures. So our rationale was we needed to be able to put in place a series of venues that's going to be able to accommodate the increase in fixtures we were going to have by entering into the Future Tours programme and the Test cricket pantheon over the next 4 to 5 years. So to take it to Dublin at the moment, we were looking initially at Malahide Cricket Club, but for the various reasons that we sort of spelled out when we announced it a couple of years back, simply the number of times we're going to need to use that venue. You know, these are members of a cricket club who would want to be able to pay their subscription to be able to use their venue. With the extraordinary increase of matches that we're going to have, we were going to get to the stage whereby we were going to use it to the extent that almost to the exclusion of their existing members. There also, we had to think about future-proofing of the whole of our permanent infrastructure, which is you tend to find that what are nice-to-haves within international requirements become minimum standards. And even the nice-to-haves at the moment would probably take it to the extent whereby we would have to go construct something that would be well beyond the requirements within a sensitive environmental area like Malahide Castle. And thirdly, the point of building a permanent stadium is to make sure that we're not going to have to be spending all the money that I mentioned that we're going to have to spend on a greenfield site. We should be investing all that money back into the sports, grassroots, clubs, provincial unions, development activity, but we can't because we're having to invest in it to nearly just wash its face in terms
of... So Abbottstown?
Abbottstown, yes. Sorry, you asked me the question 10 minutes ago. I'm just getting around now. yes, Abbottstown, National Sports Campus. Our view is that that's going to be the place that we want to put it in. We want to be able to develop our national stadium. We're in conversations now with National Sports Campus, Sport Island. Right, what size footprint do you need? What facilities do you need? How does drainage going to work? How should we phase this? How much money do you need?
How big is the press box?
All of those very important questions. How big is the press box? Yes, that's where we're looking at the moment.
So when do we get a decision? When might Ireland play its first game in Abbottstown with a fair wind at your back?
Fair wind 2022, I reckon. So let's say we get a decision this year. Money begins to flow in 2019. Building the green stuff is the issue. You can't just lay down a set of grass, nice, flat, and play on it within months, as can happen in rugby or Gaelic or football, because the cricket pitch block is a very specialised piece of agronomy, which is it requires years to bed down special clays,
what
special
about a curation.
Do you know what? We looked at that, potentially even when we were thinking about potentially ground sharing, but the costs to be able to drop it in, stick it on trays, put it next door, have to construct special greenhouses that need to be heated. Number one, it's incredibly expensive. Number two, takes up a lot of space. And number three, as Emmett would know from the Boxing Day test, Australia-England, the Ashes, if the MCG struggle to be able to afford to develop a pitch that isn't going to be fined by the ICC and potentially liable to losing its ability to host matches, then Cricket Island will certainly struggle, at least for the next 20 years.
Yeah. Last question for me is on, I suppose, outside of the cricket world, a lot of the Irish players wouldn't be all that well known, I think, to the sporting public. Do you think it's important that Cricket Ireland puts an emphasis on creating, I suppose, superstars for young kids to aspire to? And I suppose it's an irony in some respect that some of our top players are probably better known in India than they would be in this market.
Yeah. Yes. So to illustrate your point, I remember on a couple of occasions... Kevin O'Brien can probably walk down the streets of Sandy Mount and he might turn a couple of heads.
The hard streets of Sandy
Mount. Yes, I can tell you he'd go to India and he'd be mobbed and he can barely move. We've just brought on board a media and communications manager. Our first, our previous up to this was part-time. So we just brought our first permanent media and communications manager. And he's doing a presentation to the board tomorrow, which is going to be outlining the steps he's going to be taking to try and build that profile. I suppose, what have we done till now? We've worked so hard to try and ensure that our team is going to be winning, because if our team is winning, then there's profile. If there's profile, there's visibility. If there's visibility, there's interest. And if there's interest, there's the potential for more media. So we've worked very hard to invest in our men's senior squad to win in order to generate the visibility they're looking for. But we're about to get a whole load of fixtures. A whole load of fixtures means they're going to be on television. They're on television with the duration that cricket is throughout on a much more consistent basis throughout the year. We're going to begin to be able to have that visibility and build the profiles of those players.
And do you think, in terms of encouraging people to play cricket, that there were maybe barriers to entry to cricket, that people didn't see it as being a particularly Irish game, for argument's sake? Do you think those barriers to entry are gone now for young kids?
Yeah. Do you know what? Somebody said to me, yes, that might be the case, but actually when Ireland starts to win at something, all of those historical barriers tend to go away. I mean, it would be difficult not to stick hockey, rugby and football under the same barrier of English, which all went away when suddenly winning Six Nations, qualifying for World Cups 1994, suddenly, well, it doesn't feel so English anymore. I can tell you, we probably began to cross that Rubicon in March the 2nd, 2011, when we beat England at the World Cup and I was the only celebrating Englishman in the crowd.
And finally, Warren and Emmett as well, it just remains for us to ask you who's going to win this first Test match. It starts on May the 11th. What are Ireland's chances?
There's always a chance. Would we be favourites? No. We've never played a five-day game outside of the Intercontinental Cup final in 2013. I don't even know if that went 5 days, actually. No, we're not going to be favourites. It's going to be intriguing. You never quite know. Is this going to be this incredible, expectations are so low, we're suddenly going to knock it out of the park? I remember Bangladesh did extremely well their first Test match. I remember Sri Lanka did well in their first Test match as well. There was just this sort of, you know, historical moment bounce that the team seemed to get. Are we going to get the same? Who knows? I'm not going to make a prediction, but do you know what? I'd be really excited to see how we tackle it.
Given this goes for 5 days, Warren, and presumably you'd like it to last the full 5 days if possible, to get as many bums on seats, do you have a little word in the ear of William Porterfield and say, listen, if you win the toss, would you ever put Pakistan in first? Because even if they bat for 3 days, that's good for us.
You may say that I couldn't possibly comment, Kieran.
I think it's more like he has a word with Gene Byrne in the Met Office, really. I think the chance could go to a fourth day or whatever.
And have we checked the weather? Is this
this far out? It tends to be invidious to look at it. You take hope and despair in equal measure at this stage. So we'll look at it week out.
It's such a bad winter. I can guarantee you it's going to be a beautiful summer.
Well, here's hoping it's going to be a big day for Irish cricket, and let's hope the boys put on a great show. That's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Warren Dutram and Emmett Reardon. Declan Conlon produced the show with research from Dan O'Neill of Teneo PSG and JJ Vernon as sound engineer. Don't forget you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock.
And I'm Michael O'Keefe.
And until next time, take care.